Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. The Trump administration is going to start garnishing the wages of delinquent student loan borrowers. And that could have ripple effects throughout the economy.
This won't necessarily derail the economy, but it does make life harder for households already struggling.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Also today on the show, one state lawmaker wants to get rid of speed limits on some rural highways. We'll meet the students who traveled thousands of miles to attend Turning Point's annual America Fest convention.
What's next for the Arizona Cardinals after another losing season?
And why location sharing is the new trust test for Gen Z.
They know that so much information about them is already available, and they had nothing to do with it. So might as well share this with people that I want to have it.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Protesters have gathered today in Minneapolis for fresh demonstrations against yesterday's fatal shooting of a city woman by an ICE officer. The protesters want the immigration agency to leave Minneapolis. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem has defended the ICE agent. She says the driver who was killed, Renee Nicole Good, struck him with her car. NPR has reviewed multiple videos of the scene. The officer does not appear to be hit and can be seen walking after he fired the deadly shots. Minneapolis public schools are closed today and tomorrow for safety. President Trump tells the New York Times the United States could run Venezuela for years. In an interview, he says, quote, only time will tell. Trump adds that his administration is in constant contact with Venezuela's new acting president, Delcy Rodriguez. She gave a national address last night about energy and economic issues, and Pierre's Carrie Kahn reports.
Surrounded by ministers, Rodriguez forcefully spoke of what she says is now a stain on the relations between the U.S. and Venezuela, but then quickly added that it was not unusual or irregular to continue to trade with the United States.
Y no nos vamos a rendir frente a ningún tipo de agresión.
And we will not surrender to any kind of aggression, she said, then continuing that our hands are extended to all countries of the world for all types of relations, including energy cooperation. Rodriguez did not directly address comments made by U.S. officials, including Vice President Vance, who told Fox News that the U.S. now controls Venezuela's energy resources. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Bogota, Colombia.
President Trump is also continuing to demand control of Greenland. He says the U.S. should acquire the world's largest island because of national security issues. Greenland is already controlled by Denmark, a NATO ally. Experts say that Washington is likely interested in Greenland's rich mineral resources. NPR's Windsor Johnston explains.
Greenland holds large deposits of rare earth and critical minerals, materials used in everything from smartphones to fighter jets. Alexandra de Hoop Schaefer is with the German Marshall Fund. She says the U.S. sees those resources as part of a broader strategy to reduce dependence on China.
The Arctic region has really become one of the hottest spots on this planet for great power rivalry. It's a NATO issue. It's a transatlantic issue, but it's very much a global security issue.
She says that growing rivalry is why Washington is eyeing Greenland, not just for its rare earth minerals, but as a key front in the broader global security landscape. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Good morning. From KJZZ News in Phoenix, I'm Bruce Drummond. In Valley traffic on the southbound South Mountain Loop 202 near Viquiva Way, we've got a crash blocking the left lanes still there. Arizona's large measles outbreak continues to grow. Most cases so far have been in Mojave County, but Coconino County reported a case last week, and now Pima County is reporting its first case. Nicole Witt with the Arizona Department of Health Services says Arizonans should be aware the extremely contagious virus is still spreading.
While we have been very lucky that we haven't seen as many cases spread to other counties, we are starting to see cases in other parts of our state as well. And just a reminder to everyone to continue to be vigilant.
Witt says vaccination is the best protection against measles. 97% of cases in Arizona's outbreak have been among unvaccinated people. Glendale police face a new lawsuit stemming from a shooting about a year ago that was a case of mistaken identity. KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports that one of the officers involved was fired about a month ago.
Court records say Glendale police inexplicably shifted their attention from trying to see inside a vehicle where a domestic violence suspect had shot himself to Dylan Seebeck sitting in a park hundreds of feet away. The complaint says police had no basis to believe Seebeck was the suspect, as he was twice their age and a different ethnicity. The lawsuit filed by Seebeck's brother accuses the sergeant on scene of failing to intervene after shots were fired and alleges the sergeant withheld medical aid after Seebeck was hit. Glendale officials say internal reviews found the shooting was out of policy. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Very good chance for some more rain today in the Phoenix area. We topped out at 60 yesterday. Not much change for the next day or so. We're expecting about 61 degrees for the high today, 6 below normal, about 60 again tomorrow. And then we'll start to rise a little bit as we head through the weekends. We should be in the mid-60s by Saturday.
KJZZ is supported by Starlux Airlines, flying nonstop from Phoenix Sky Harbor to Taipei starting January 15th. Travelers can also connect to destinations across Asia and beyond on Starlux Airlines. Information at starlux-airlines.com.
Cloudy skies, 55 degrees at 9:06.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how a common class of chemicals in everyday products could affect women's fertility.
And location sharing is the new sign of friendship for Gen Z, but are there privacy concerns to consider?
But first, the Trump administration says it's going to start garnishing the wages of student loan borrowers who are at least 270 days past due on their payments. The Fed say that'll only happen after borrowers get notice of the action and have a chance to repay their loans. This follows attempts by the Biden administration to forgive student loans. Those efforts were struck down by the courts. The U.S. Education Department says as of last September, there were more than 924,000 borrowers in Arizona. Combined, they carry nearly $34 billion in debt. With me to talk more about this is economist Luis Cordova, vice president of Rounds Consulting Group. And Luis, how big of an economic impact might this move by the Trump administration have?
So this won't necessarily derail the economy, but it does make life harder for households already struggling, and that can show up in local spending. So when you look into the numbers, I think it's about 1 in 6 borrowers are severely delinquent on payments. So that means that the majority of borrowers are not directly affected by garnishment. So this is not likely to create a large economic shock. However, the impact is highly concentrated among lower income borrowers, households that are already financially stretched. So for those, you know, households, a $200 to $300 monthly payment is meaningful. This could mean, you know, cutting back on discretional spending, like going out to eat or going on a trip. So these cuts in discretional spending could have a small impact on local retail, restaurants and service.
So as you say, it sounds like the biggest impact is going to be on for families or borrowers that are already not doing great. This is going to be kind of one more thing that helps them continue to not do great. Is that a fair assessment?
Right. So the impact really is, you know, it's a, I would say like an uneven impact. So the real impact would be on those households that are experiencing current hardship. So they could, you know, continue putting off on other financial decisions like remodeling their homes, buying homes, or even starting a family. But really, it's going to be more about cutting back on discretional spending.
Might this have an impact on the state's economy more broadly if folks who are already, as you described, maybe not doing well, they're stretched financially, if they need, for example, based on losing some of their wages to pay off these debts, if they start to perhaps, for example, rely on state services, might that have an impact there?
There could be an impact there. Again, because it is such a small percentage that is severely delinquent, it's not likely to be a huge number, but really it's going to be at the individual level, really to see what the impact is there.
Do you think that by the federal government taking this action, will it make potential borrowers think differently about whether or not they want to take out a student loan in the first place?
That's a good question. So in general, education still has a strong return on investment. I mean, there's no question about that. Higher education leads to higher lifetime earnings, improved job stability, expanded career options. But like any investment, outcomes will vary. So student loans can be a good investment, but like any investment, you have to be smart about it.
So you mentioned that this is most likely to affect sort of a concentrated group of borrowers. But I wonder if, based on economic factors, more people could sort of be pulled into this. Like, is it possible that, you know, depending on how the economy goes, people who have been or are currently able to repay their student loans might not be able to do that at some point, and they could also have their wages garnished and maybe start this cycle of impact, maybe a little bit bigger than what it looks like it might be now?
Yeah, so that's something we do have to keep an eye out on, because the economy has been slow, and with a lot of the federal actions that are going on, that can still put a drag on a lot of these inflationary factors that we're having. So affordability is still going to be an issue this coming year. Housing costs are still very high. Inflation is persistent. And any, you know, minor shocks to the economy, like, say, you know, we do go into even a mild recession where we do have, you know, a lot of layoffs, that sort of thing, then this could become a real big problem for sure.
What's the benefit to the federal government of doing this?
Well, I mean, like any kind of loan, student loan is like a credit card, right? So the money was used up front. So really, it should be paid back. It goes into, you know, should the federal government forgive loans? Targeted forgiveness makes sense in specific areas like public service roles, teachers, nurses, first responders. Also in areas where there are critical workforce shortages and cases of institutional failure or fraud. So those programs serve a public benefit, and they help attract and retain workers where we need them the most. So forgiveness makes sense there, but across the board, forgiveness is, you know, expensive, and it really raises fairness concerns that can encourage future over borrowing. So broad forgiveness creates real fairness issues, especially for people who already paid their loans or chose not to borrow, but targeted forgiveness makes economic sense.
I know that we've talked about that this is sort of a small group of borrowers who are going to be affected, but I'm curious to get your take on this. The Education Department, the Federal Education Department, says that borrowers in Arizona hold nearly $34 billion in debt. That seems like an awfully big number, and based on what you're saying earlier about potential economic shifts, it almost seems like that's kind of a dark cloud almost hovering over people and maybe the state, depending on how things go. It just seems like an awfully big number for debt that, you know, at some point could get called in against, you know, the ability to pay of people who hold it.
Yeah, you're right. So So one thing we saw, you know, when we did have a pause on student loan payments is we did see a lot of spending in the economy, which contributed to inflation. But that's why at the state level, we saw, you know, a lot of sales tax revenues coming in. And that is because people had more money to spend. So it's kind of it's really a shift of where that money is spent. And in terms of like state revenues, you know, there's a tax on retail sales. So we would want to have that shift move more towards, you know, restaurants, retail shops, that kind of thing. So really you're just moving the money to be spent somewhere else. So yeah, that is something to keep an eye out.
All right. That is Luis Cordova, vice president with Rounds Consulting Group and an economist. Luis, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, the new legislative session hasn't even started, and there are already proposed laws that are getting people talking. And two of those come from surprise Republican Nick Cupper. One would reduce the age at which a teenager can get their driving permit to 15 years, down from 15 and 6 months. And the other would remove speed limits on some rural interstates, beginning with a pilot program between Yuma and Casa Grande. That's right, no speed limits on some rural roads. The only requirement would be to drive at a, quote, reasonable and prudent speed. Well, our next guest says Arizona may not be the place to test out loosening traffic laws. Tim Steller writes an opinion column for the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson, and he's on the line now to tell us why. Good morning, Tim.
Good rainy morning to you.
Good rainy morning. So you're arguing that Arizona has one of the worst traffic death problems in the country. In fact, tell us what the problem looks like here.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a few different ways to measure this, but the way that the Insurance Institute, how do you phrase that? The Insurance Institute relies on is deaths per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. So it's a rate. And Arizona has the second highest rate out of all the states, plus D.C. and Puerto Rico, 1.73 fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. As usual, we're spared from being the worst in the country by Mississippi, which has a rate of 1.79 deaths per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we don't fare well when it comes to traffic fatalities. By comparison, just in case your listeners want to know, the best state was Massachusetts with 0.56 deaths per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. So anyway, we have a problem, you know, this representative's proposals purport to aim to address it. I'm not quite sure I believe that would work.
Right. So let's talk about that. So Representative Cupper did an interview about this with Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services, and he said he kind of totally understands, like, if people think this is a crazy idea, that it will lead to deaths, but he argued that there's data to prove otherwise. He said states where there are lower ages for driver's permits, for example, they have lower rates of teen traffic fatalities, and that under his bill, teens would actually have their permits longer. But you took this to that Insurance Institute for Traffic Safety. What did they have to say?
Actually, Howie did that, and they said no, the lower essentially what they argue for is not about the lower the age for driving is worse, is their point of view, and they do the research on this themselves. But more than that, there's an issue within this, which is not about the age at which a person gets a permit, but about the amount of time they're required to drive with a licensed driver in order to practice.
Right.
In Arizona right now, we only require 30 hours with a licensed driver. There are other ways also to make this by taking a driver class, that sort of thing. Another group that I've interviewed is called Advocates for Traffic Safety. They recommend 70 hours
right.
as a standard. And so the thing about Cupper's bill as it pertains to permitting is that it changes the time during which a person may have a permit, but it doesn't change the amount of driving that they might have to do in order to practice to get their license.
Yeah. The idea of lowering the age limit at which you can get a permit has been attempted before at the state legislature, and it was opposed at the time from the state's major insurance companies. Do you anticipate that happening again here?
Sure, yeah. And, you know, this is early times in the session. Who knows how these bills might change or whether they'll get a hearing. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that there will be some pushback on this.
There have been states that have tried the other issue at hand here, this no speed limits on interstates thing, kind of, you know, years or decades ago. Even Nevada, Montana didn't have speed limits on mm-hmm. some roads for a long time. Is this sort of a classic libertarian individual rights issue from your point of view?
I mean, I smell that in the proposal, but, you know, I must acknowledge that he cites Montana. Cooper cites Montana as an example, and there is some data, some research to show that when they eliminated speed limits on some rural interstates, safety did not get worse. In fact, it may have improved, especially in the daytime. You know, you have to have a daytime, a nighttime limit and daytime no limit. But an issue that these traffic safety advocates brought up to me is enforcement. Like, so the standard becomes reasonable and prudent,
right.
A speed reasonable and prudent. You know, how on earth is a state trooper to determine that? I'm sure it would be spelled out in law, but it seems rather like a gray area.
Yeah. And in the last minute here, Tim, along the lines of those state troopers, our state troopers have been sounding the alarm for years now about understaffing and pay. Like, they say there are huge stretches of time when there are no troopers on those rural roads outside of cities in the middle of the night, especially. Is there anyone out there to enforce this kind of thing anyway?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, enforcement overall is necessary if these traffic laws are going to make any difference. So, yeah, I mean, there would have to be enforcement. However, when you talk about training or other aspects of traffic safety, those don't require troopers on the roads. You know, if we're going to require more driving practice for permit holders, that's just them being out there with their parents or some guardian or something. I mean, other states requires 12 or more other states require vehicle safety inspections every year or two. We don't, of course, do that. And so there's all kinds of things we don't do that aren't involving state troopers pulling people over on the interstates or other roads.
Interesting. All right, we'll leave it there. Tim Steller with the Arizona Daily Star joining us. Tim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, is sharing your location with friends and family a sign of trust or an invasion of privacy? Why location sharing is a given for so many young people.
But first, just before this past Christmas, the Phoenix Convention Center hosted one of the most significant political events of 2025, Turning Point USA's annual America Fest. You may have seen some of the big headlines about it. Turning Point President Erica Kirk endorsing J.D. Vance for president in 2028, for example, or rapper Nicki Minaj making an appearance. But while what happened on stage at America Fest is important, it's also critical to understand what was happening out in the crowd. Over 30,000 people from all over the country packed the convention hall, many of them teenagers and college students. They came from all over the country, and their reasons for traveling thousands of miles and spending thousands of dollars to be there are an important part of the story. Our co-host Sam Dingman was at America Fest, along with the show's senior producer Nick Sanchez and KJZZ's political correspondent Cameron Sanchez. They sat down recently to debrief about the people they met.
So, Cameron, Nick, we have completed our second visit in 2 years to Turning Point's annual America Fest convention. Nick, this was your second time also, right?
Yes.
But Cameron, this is your
third
time.
Yeah.
What I wanted to do today was to talk about what it felt like to be there this year as opposed to last year, because obviously the identity of the organization has been transformed tremendously in the wake of Charlie Kirk's murder. Cameron, I wanted to start by introducing us to a woman that you met on the convention floor. Mm-hmm. This is a young woman named Ellie Brown.
I think a lot of Christians are like scared to speak out in politics because they're just like, oh, they just want to like stay silent.
you know, Turning Point's always been a religious thing since we've been going. I think a lot of people who were there said the same thing to me, which is that they felt Charlie Kirk was a very virtuous person, a religious person, devout person, and they are generally Christians who can relate to that.
Absolutely. But I would say the difference between 2024's event and 2025's event is that in 2024, it felt more politically motivated. 2025 felt more faith-driving politics.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think the first year I was at America Fest, they hadn't had that big red wave yet, right? So it was very much about the urgency of, like, we've got to get things back from the Democrats. We've got to fight. We've got to get out the vote. And then the year that you guys joined me in 2024 was, yes, victory, the red wave, we did it, power, you know, triumph and joy and keep the momentum going. And then this year, everybody is pretty much there for Charlie and talking about God.
Yes, yes. Well, in that vein, I want to introduce you guys to a woman that I met. Her name is Kai Harrelson. She was there from Florida.
Like, people could just relate to him. Sorry, I get, like, yeah. I got bullied a lot. And so, yeah, him, like, seeing him once I got into high school, I felt safe to be able to, like, express my views and beliefs.
So what was potent to me about this conversation with Kai was this idea that in her experience, finding Charlie Kirk was not just a way to find a political project that she could get on board with, but it was a way to feel safe to express her true self.
I think what you hear there is very representative, I think at least for me, across everybody who I got to talk to there at America Fest, was the power of the personal connection that everybody has, or a lot of people have, with Charlie or had with Charlie.
Yeah. I think there's been a lot of conversation when it comes to Kirk about the young people that he has brought to the conservative movement in the United States. But as we've been talking about, it seems like he's done a lot of that through religion. The call to faith has been the primary thing for some of them, and then politics has been an extension of that.
I mean, I think Charlie Kirk saw opportunity with certain groups of people, right? Like, the youth typically goes to the left. In history, this has been the case, right? The youth are more liberal. And Charlie Kirk saw that, and he saw that there was a group of folks who felt like they couldn't speak out because they were conservative, and they were in a group of folks who, based on their age, were not. And so he made them feel like they were kind of being persecuted, but that they could go to him and to his movement, and that he would give them a place and a purpose.
Charlie Kirk's widow, Erica Kirk, is now in charge of the organization. And to that end, let's meet Melody Brittingham.
Yeah, I just think she's a very feminine, beautiful woman, and she is so in love with God. She has so much wisdom.
What was striking to you about Melody?
Well, she's not alone, right? So young women see her as basically an example, both as a mother and as the leader of Turning Point and as Charlie Kirk's wife and widow. You know, they're like, we have the same values as you, as we want to achieve the things that you've achieved. And they say that they relate to her because she is a woman, and they say that they share a feminine experience.
And that's why I think it's so important to hear from these young women in particular. Let's meet just one more of them. This is another person you spoke to, Cameron, Stephanie Barella.
I just think she's an incredibly strong woman who really is firm in her faith, and that's how she's able to get through this horrible tragedy that she's had to go through.
I think it's fair to say that this idea of Erica grieving wrong, that she shouldn't be so public in her grief, which is commentary that we see at the national level a lot when it comes to Erica, that could not have been less true to the perception of the people that I spoke to at America Fest. They see her as having been presented with practically a saintly challenge and actually rising to the occasion, meeting the moment in a way that they seem to find very inspiring.
1,000%. And I've talked to folks about this who, you know, are not really in the political scene, who obviously would never want to go to Turning Point or don't know anything about Turning Point. And they have said that to me. And I'm like, well, you know, far be it from me to say what Charlie Kirk would have wanted. But this is very much what he was about. And she is absolutely leaning into it. I do think that Charlie Kirk was in people's lives every day for many years in many formats. He had the podcast, the show, and Erica Kirk, you know, she can build up her image, but there's just no way to get around the fact that she hasn't done that. No one else has. No one else, I mean, can unless they start from scratch, but they're not there yet. And so I think that there's still that loss. You know, it feels like loss in the air of Charlie. That presence is gone from people's lives.
Well, this for me gets to the piece of tape that I have not been able to stop thinking about. This is a woman named Pam Daniel, and she was there because she has two teenage sons who were very affected by Charlie's death. They're 16 years old and 17 years old. And in this clip, you're going to hear her telling me about the day they found out that he had died.
And my 16-year-old, who doesn't show a lot of emotion, he started crying. And I said, I was surprised. And I asked him, he said, Mom, I listened to him every day and I looked up to him. And he goes, it's just, I'm shocked and I'm really, really sad. I mean, he definitely does feel, but he hides his emotions more. And I was just shocked when I saw him crying. And I didn't know they listened every single day. And I didn't realize how much he looked up to him. And it's just opened up a door for so many more conversations. And I really think it's made us even closer than we were before.
That clip is so powerful because I think this shows, for a lot of people, this is deeper than politics. Like, it's somebody in their family. Like, Charlie is we talk about, you know, back in the day, somebody who was very effective on TV, a personality, a news anchor, a show host, who it felt like they were in your living room with you. I think for a lot of people, Charlie Kirk was in their living room with them.
I think that's really well said, that it, for a lot of these young people, it was not a relationship with a political idea. It was a relationship with a guy who they felt like they knew really well.
I think this sort of, for me, makes me think that there are people who will listen to stories that we've done on America Fest and be like, you know, why are we hearing so much about this? This is just a small fringe. Like, you know, do really people actually listen to this stuff or care about this? Why are we amplifying it? You know what I mean? And I think those people completely miss the point. We're talking about an event with 30,000 plus people, representative of millions of people in this country. That's very much the mainstream. They helped to get Donald Trump elected. He is the president. J.D. Vance was at the event. That is the vice president of the United States of America. And these kids throughout the United States, they are being reached by this kind of social media, podcasting, whatever it is. I think people would be surprised if they knew just how far this extends and how long it's been going on for.
Well, we're going to have a lot more to say about this on the show in the coming days and weeks. But for now, I have been speaking with the show's senior producer, Nick Sanchez. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
And Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk here at KJZZ. Thank you, Cameron.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The NFL playoffs get underway this weekend, and once again, they will not include the Arizona Cardinals. The team finished the season with a record of 3 wins and 14 losses. That includes a 9-game losing streak to end the season. The Cardinals are also looking for a new head coach after firing Jonathan Gannon, who'd accumulated a 15-36 record over his three seasons leading the team. They could also be in the market for a new quarterback. With me now to talk about what the future could look like for the Cards is Brad Sesmat, CEO of Sports360AZ.com. Brad, good morning.
Mark, you want to talk about the Fiesta Bowl or the Suns or Diamondback spring training is 3 weeks away,
yes,
or the WM Open got Scottie Scheffler to commit. I mean,
hey, you agreed to come on to talk about the Cardinals, so I'm going to hold you to that. We don't have time, I think, to get into the what went wrong for the Cards. We only have about 6 minutes, so let's look.
Right.
I want to ask, like, when the Cardinals are looking for a new head coach, which they are doing again, what kinds of attributes do you think they should be looking for?
It's a great question because the Cardinal owner, this is the fourth time in 8 years he's interviewing for a head coach.
Mm.
So, Michael, what questions are you asking? Or are you just sitting across from people wanting to hear what you want to hear? Mark, since 2018, they're 46-86. So
that's
not
great.
What are we doing here? No, what exactly is going on here? This isn't about Kyler Murray. This isn't about former general managers' missed draft picks. This is squarely 100% on the owner. And until the owner gets it right, because he likes to be one of these hands-on owners, and I've covered them all. I've covered Donald Sterling. I've covered them all through the years. And this owner is just one that likes the spotlight and likes it to be about him. And it doesn't matter if the team is 40 games under 500 since 2018. So what's he looking for? I can't read his mind. His track record shows that he likes to go with the young or hot assistant coach names like Matt Nagy with the Kansas City Chiefs. That's great. Hire Matt Nagy. Is he bringing Patrick Mahomes with him? I think the answer is no. So you can go hire guys that have a great resume in other places. But what we have become here is we're the Cleveland Browns. Every year we're picking in the top five, top eight, who's the next quarterback's going to be. By the end of October, we're looking ahead to spring training. And that just shouldn't be the case in the NFL. It just shouldn't. And, you know, I talk about them on my shows and write about them as the Super Cardinals because I get this air of arrogance that we've got it all figured out. And no, you don't. How about just the simple, guys, we've tried really hard. Please stick with us. I've done a bad job of hiring coaches and personnel. I am going to take full responsibility for this. I am going to lean in and say, fans, please believe in us. You can bring Clint Kubiak in, who's up at Seattle as their offensive coordinator. Most fans haven't heard of Clint Kubiak unless you really follow the NFL. It's great. He has the top wide receiver in the NFL. Seahawks hit on their number one pick with the wide receiver. Cardinals, I would say Marvin Harrison Jr. right now. I'm not going to use the B word. That's not fair to call him a bust, but that's been a miss so far. There's no other way to put it.
Well, so that kind of raises the question, Brad. I mean, you referenced Kyler Murray, and there's been some talk that maybe the Cardinals are ready to move on from him. Do you have a sense of if they are looking maybe for a new quarterback, either in the draft or free agency, or they're ready to keep rolling with Murray?
Well, Mark, let's just go to the fans for a minute. I think I would guess 90% of the people listening to you and I right now would say, please, we've heard enough about, is this the year of Kyler Murray? Kyler Murray to me feels like a guy that's let's press reset. He needs to go to another organization. That is easy to say, but there's a big bonus attached to Kyler Murray with his contract, which starts in March. Early March will be when we know if Kyler Murray is the quarterback or not for this franchise, because they've got to decide what they're going to do with him. You could make the argument, Mark, that this is a good job because you're going to have the third overall pick. You have Kyler Murray that you could probably spin into some assets or maybe not. Maybe his image is too damaged or maybe the small in stature quarterback deals caught up with him in the NFL. I simply don't know on that. I've heard that from agents. I don't know that to be true. Is there a loaded roster here in Arizona? The answer on that is mixed. You can point to Trey McBride, who got all these catches
a tight
this
end.
Year. Yeah, right. And when I hear about injuries, guess what? That's life in the NFL. If you're going to fall every year on, well, look at all the injuries we had, but you guys still need to stick with us because we're 46-86 since 2018. I don't think the fans buy that. I don't.
So it's kind of sounds like, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't sound like you think this is whoever comes in as the new coach, that this is sort of a quick fix, like, hey, we're going to make the playoffs in 2 to 3 years.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. You have to hit on a bunch of things. Like,
okay.
I'll just use Seattle as an example, Mark. Seattle hit on a whole bunch of their draft picks. When you have to go out into free agency and hit on players, that means you missed in the draft. The Cardinals have had to dive into free agency because they've missed on draft picks. For years, they've missed on draft picks. If they hit on Josh Rosen at quarterback, they don't have to take Kyler Murray. But they missed. So now they're on their second top 10 pick of a quarterback that it looks like that they missed on. I feel like this all 100% comes down to the owner. 100%. It's not that Monty Austin Forrest does a nice enough job, but when you've been in the valley like I have for 33 years and you've seen the same movie over and over and over, you know the boat sinks at the end. Okay? And so 2009, I was at the Super Bowl in Tampa Bay. That's a long time ago. Bruce Arians, great hire. Ken Whisenhunt, great hire. Denny Green drafted some very good players that got them headed in the right direction. Since then, you know, you can change out the GM, you can change out the players, you can change out the locker room, but it 100% comes down to this owner figuring it out. And 46-86, and he's the one that's making the decision. He'll say, well, I'd ask my lieutenants. No, you're the leader. Please take 100% responsibility.
All right. So, Brad, we have to leave it there, but I promise we will have you back on to talk about happier stuff at some point. All right.
So let's see. We've got the WM coming up. We've got Women's Final Four. Mark.
Yeah.
We've got the LPGA.
Lots of good stuff coming
up. I'm always happy to come on with you, Mark.
All right. We'll have you back. That is Brad Sesmat, CEO of Sports360AZ.com. Good as always to talk to you, Brad. Thank you.
Stay well.
Researchers at the University of Arizona have received a nearly $3 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to study the impact of phthalates on women's fertility. Phthalates are a family of chemicals that are found in a number of consumer products, ranging from plastics to food packaging to beauty care products. Zellian Craig is an associate professor in the School of Animal and Comparative Biomedical Sciences at the University of Arizona. She describes the chemicals as having different arms. The type of arm they have can dictate how they're used. Craig joins me to talk more about her research. And Zellian, are some of those arms more likely to end up seeping into our systems than others?
Yeah, so we are exposed to them as they are used in, for example, in plastics. They're not permanently stuck on the plastic. They're part of the plastic backbone, but they're more of a temporary component of the plastic. So when the plastics start being used or it start to kind of wear down, they can actually come off and they can enter the body through whatever route, you know, if it's something that we can inhale or if something that we were eating from, like a food packaging or something like that, they can actually enter the body. And the types of arms will determine kind of what their overall structure is and what they can interact with when once they enter a human or an animal's body.
So if you are exposed to a phthalate, the effect it has on your body, it sounds like it will depend on from where you were exposed.
Yes, it will depend from where and what kind of phthalate. What are the things that it can interact with? So a lot of things in our bodies interact with chemicals, kind of like a key in a doorknob and a lock. So if we have different phthalates that have different shapes and different arms, then they're going to be able to interact with different parts or different locks in the body. And the where they can get to will depend on how we were exposed. So for example, if we have a exposure that we're breathing in, obviously that's going to get through our heart and our lungs first, right? Because those are the two things that are going to be inside when you inhale something. But if it's something that is eaten, the first targets are going to be our, you know, gastrointestinal tract, our guts, our liver, and then from there it goes to the rest of the body. And if it's on our skin, then it will actually get absorbed through the skin and it can actually go through into our bloodstream in that way.
And is it safe to say that depending on which system in our body is exposed to the phthalates, it will have a different impact? Like, are some, is it more dangerous in some parts of our body than others?
So that's actually things that we are investigating, is which exposure matters the most and where, what places are the ones that have the highest impact, right, on human health. But one of the things that we know is that a lot of our exposures in the population come from oral exposure, so ingestion.
And am I right also that in some ways these chemicals impact women more than men?
Yeah, we think that women are more susceptible to this. And this is based on a few observations. First of all, the Centers for Disease Control have been tracking levels of phthalates in human populations for quite a bit, quite a long time, since 2001. And they know that they are showing up in urine samples of our general population. And when they look at, they break down the data from humans, they look at, you know, different age groups, the two different sexes, and they actually observed that the highest levels of some phthalates were in women compared to men. So women had greater levels. And since we've become more aware about phthalates and their effects, people have reduced their use. But one thing that is very interesting to us is that despite phthalates in general, the levels are starting to go down in the population, women still have higher levels of some phthalates compared to men. And a lot of that is, tends to be attributed to, you know, the use of products and that contain phthalates. It might be different between the two sexes.
Do we know if the chemicals impact men's and women's bodies differently?
Yeah, so there are, so the phthalates have this potential to interact with cells in the body, and that potential is very similar, right? What changes is that males and females have different cell types, for example, in their reproductive system. Mm. So the way that each organ reacts is going to be different. So in general, we say that phthalates are not good for the function of hormones in the reproductive system in both sexes. But we also have specific concerns that are a little bit more enhanced in females because they not only have reproductive function to handle, but they also will handle, for example, a developing fetus, they will handle lactation. So there are a little bit more things that we are concerned about in the female side, but they can be a threat for both males and females.
Can the phthalates also impact whether or not a woman can get pregnant to begin with?
Yeah, actually, most of what we know about phthalates and the main driver for my personal interest in understanding how they do these things comes from populations of women that have been studied at the clinic. So these are women that go to the clinic because maybe their partner is having trouble with reproduction. So they seek medically assisted reproduction. And so they represent a very useful group in science. So you can study how much phthalate is in their urine and compare that to the different outcomes of the interventions that are done in the clinic. And some of those have to do with their fertility. And so from those studies, we know that women that have high phthalates in their urine, and that's a sign that they have more exposure to phthalates, they tend to have less eggs in their ovaries. They tend to respond less to the stimulations that they receive to ovulate at the clinic. And there's also been some studies that have shown that the greater the phthalate level in their urine, the less likely they are to have a pregnancy to term. So they tend to have fertility issues if they have higher phthalate levels in their urine.
Hmm. Is this the kind of family of chemicals that you think it would be possible just to stop using, to do away with?
Yeah, actually. And that's one of the things that have been done in Europe, in California. There have been very significant and I think effective efforts to reduce their use. One of the challenges with phthalates is that there is a whole family of them. So a lot of the work that has been accomplished so far in their regulation includes what we will call legacy phthalates, which are the phthalates that were first discovered to be detrimental. And so there's sufficient body of work and research showing that they're not good. And so those actually have been practically banned from a lot of products. The highest priority was baby toys and things like that. Mm-hmm. And California is actually kind of leading quite a bit in this aspect to getting some of them removed. But there are so many of them that we are still, we're working towards that goal, but we haven't been able to ban them all or substitute them.
All right. Mm-hmm. That is Zellianne Craig, an associate professor in the School of Animal and Comparative Biomedical Sciences at the University of Arizona. Zellianne, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Well, here's something I didn't know as a member of the elderly millennial generation. A whole lot of people younger than me share their locations on their phones pretty much all the time with apps like Find My and Life 360. Location sharing is becoming a common way that parents track where their kids are. Friends often track each other. Significant others check in on one another. The generational divide here is clear. Research from Civic Science shows more than 40% of U.S. adults currently share their location with someone. But for Gen Z, it's 65%. For those older than 55, just 24%. So what is it? Is location sharing a sign of trust in a relationship? Is it peace of mind for parents? Or is it a violation of privacy? I spoke with Brad Snyder for his take. He's an author and researcher who studies kids for governments and companies like Warner Brothers Discovery, Cartoon Network, and Nickelodeon. He told me it has to do with the digital world that Gen Z has always been steeped in.
I think it goes to this idea of what is privacy and what are we so concerned about? And it's kind of worth thinking about that because young people already seem to recognize that these social media companies already have so much information about them. They are already sharing so much information about themselves that making it more convenient for people that they like and that they trust just makes sense. They know that so much information about them is already available, and they had nothing to do with it. So might as well share this with people that I want to have it.
That's really interesting. It's a very different kind of starting point, I think. This also comes into play a lot, and I know this from, you know, being a parent of young kids, like for parents where it's almost like you feel like an irresponsible parent these days if you don't know where your kid is all the time. Like if you don't, you know, have an iTag on them or something like that, if you let them ride their bike around the neighborhood. There's a layer of almost big brother that feels almost a given now in parenting. Are you seeing that?
I am. And it's interesting because it's artificial. I hear it from my school district clients when they try to impose smartphone controls in schools. Often it's the parents that push back the most on any sort of restrictions of having cell phones or having them open or having them on school grounds. And we need to think back about exactly what are we afraid of? There's a couple of paradoxes in this world. And one of the paradoxes is that we as adults are so upset that our children spend so much time in mediated digital spaces.
Yeah.
We want them to be outside playing. We want them to be running around, but yet we're afraid to let them go outside and play.
Yeah. Yeah, that question of what are we afraid of is a very interesting one in parenting right now. I mean, I kept thinking about as I was reading about this, like a time when I was a kid when your parent would go to the grocery store and you didn't know, you know, exactly where they were when they were coming home or something like that.
Yeah.
Like they didn't have a cell phone with them the whole time. You just sort of have to talk to them or ask them that question when they got home, whenever that may be. And
exactly.
There wasn't kind of a panic about people's whereabouts. Is something lost, you think, in always knowing or always having the option to know?
I think there's something lost in feeling like you have to access an information. I think it is that we do let fear govern way too much of how we approach parenting. And we're afraid of things that like don't exist in any sort of measurable or statistics way. I mean, we know that our neighborhoods are far safer than they've been for 10, 20, 30 years, if we look at the overall trends. And that includes things like child abductions, far lower today than at any time that we've been tracking that in the years. Now, one abduction is too many, but we do have to think about, well, what are we balancing and what are we losing? And one of the things that we are losing is our children's ability to experiment and find out for themselves when something isn't working or when it's not meeting their needs. And one of the things that we know, for example, about how children and teens, I'm talking about now, approach privacy decisions when it comes to digital devices, is that they approach a new environment or an online space, a social network, and they're open on it and they are inclusive on it until somebody on it gives them reason not to be. And then they do put in their own restrictions. They change friend groups. They block people. They change and eliminate posts. Where we as older, as parents, we tend to want to put the blocks in place before they post those things.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting difference, right? And you're kind of tapping into this conversation that's broader right now about independence for young people in general, but for kids in particular, where, you know, there is a big loss of that. And that seems to be affecting their development, their, I guess, ability to fail, to get hurt.
Right. Well, and this is something that we've known for a really long time in the child development world that kids need. They need opportunities to try things and fail and try again until they get it right. It turns out this is one of the greatest ways that we can learn things and how we as all humans really want to learn. But we've decreased the opportunities for them to do this in the real world. And then we turn around and go, well, why do they spend so much time in these video games, for example? Well, because in those video games, they are allowed to try something and fail and try again.
Let me ask you about, I guess, kind of the underlying tension with this idea of location sharing, Brad. Like, I wonder if you're talking about independence in kids or privacy concerns for people in general who are location sharing, is this about something more profound or maybe the loss of something more profound? Like, is it about sort of the loss of trust in maybe our partners, maybe our family, maybe our kids, or maybe just the loss of our trust in our communities, our society?
Well, I can tell you about a study that's actually a little bit over a decade old now. And it was actually conducted by or in cooperation with the American Bar Association, because they were seeing, again, for the first time, they were seeing all this discovery of digital records. I need to see all of your email exchanges, and I need to see them from your fake email accounts, and I need to see them from... And what the researchers who did this work were concluding and what they saw in the children, these families that were going through divorce, is that hiding things in a digital space is bad. And these children were concluding that the answer is to be completely transparent in the digital world. You don't like hide your email. You let other people see it. And in fact, for a little while, it was being written about that a rite of passage of young romantic relationships was when they exchanged passwords for their email accounts.
Huh. I wonder what your advice would be to parents maybe, or maybe even to young people as they're considering this idea of location sharing. And is it a moot point? Is it something, you know, they should weigh together?
Well, fortunately, it all goes back to kind of like social emotional intelligence. What we can recognize in a situation to know whether or not this situation is dangerous, whether or not the people around us have our interests in heart, what to do when we feel pressure or anxious or nervous. So this kind of intelligence applies to every situation, but it also helps us recognize when we are being asked in a digital space for information that we shouldn't be being asked or being asked by somebody that doesn't need it and shouldn't be asking for it, or knowing how to block somebody when they are misusing personal information that I gave them. So it kind of all goes back to more basic relationship skills and self-regulatory skills.
That's interesting. All back to the basics. All right, we'll leave it there for now. That is Brad Snyder, an author and researcher, host of the podcast Talking About Kids, joining us. Brad, thank you for coming on. Thanks for taking the time to talk this through. I appreciate it.
It was wonderful. Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. You can find more of the show and sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also find us on Instagram at kjzztheshow.